live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us. We are up for an empowering hour. We're going to talk about how fennel, the herb, but most people have it in a form that's dried. I'm suggesting fennel roll diced into a salad. It can help reduce a lot of symptoms in postmenopausal women. This is from the Jundaspur University Medical Sciences in Iran. We also can look at exercise protecting the brain from Alzheimer's, University of British Columbia. And green tea consumption can lower diabetes risk in women, especially if you eat rice. And this is from a university in Japan, and much more on health and healing. Then we're going to do some commentaries. I've gotten a lot of feedback, especially among younger millennials who want to know more on what's the truth of the social issues, since there's so much bias, so much politicking, so much posturing, so much ego, self-interest. They just want to know what's the truth on all these issues. So we've selected some social issues, and I'm going to go through a lot of them today. For example, what do I believe will be the biggest right now bubble collapsing in the near future? I'll tell you. And what about all those figures, how well the economy is doing? It's only a partial truth. There are people benefiting from this economy, but they're not benefiting. 260 million are not benefiting. My guest in the second part of our program today is Professor David Montgomery, and we're going to talk about the need for a new paradigm and global revolution in agriculture to bring our soil back to life and preserve food security. I'll also be adding in some ideas that I believe will be the next major revolution back to the earth. Now, we had it for a while in the late 60s and early 70s. And I was a part of that with the Fertile Earth Farm upstate. And that was the only organic teaching farm in the eastern United States outside of Rodell's down in Emmaus, Pennsylvania. But theirs was really not a teaching farm. Theirs was a very good research facility. I knew Robert Rodell. I had met his father, J.I. Rodell. Didn't know him personally, but Robert and I communicated a lot. He was a really good person. Also a commentary today, A Last Chance for Resistance, Chris Hedges, Truth Dig. And then we're going to look at, since we say we care about the environment, I'm going to give you 14 fossil fuel projects that are in place going forward now and only going to worsen the environment. So how on the one hand can we say we care about our environment? The World Bank says we care about the devastation of global warming, and out of the other side of their mouth, they're funding a $7 billion coal-powered plant in Mongolia, mainly to extract copper. So yeah, they're concerned, and yeah, they say we do not want to get close to that extinction level, 4 degrees Celsius increase, and yet what they're doing, what they're funding, is contributing to that race to extinction. So I'm going to get into a lot of these issues today, and if we have time, I'll try to get to some of our audio files, including one by James Corbett, who's now on the Progressive Radio Network. And he's talking about how Monsanto's been employing a troll army to silence online dissent. And then how Seth Rich was murdered. Who's Seth Rich? We believe he is the man who took 24,000 emails out of the Democratic National Committee and got them into the hands of an ambassador in a park near George Washington University, who then got them into the hands of WikiLeaks. It was not the Russians. This whole Russian thing is not true. We'll tell you more about that. And so that's it. I mean, that's a full show. Let's begin. Most people enjoy fennel. It has kind of a licorice taste. What I like is fresh fennel. And what you do is you thinly slice it and you can do a light grilling of it, or just a light, or maybe a temperature hot enough that it causes a slight cooking, but not hot enough that it destroys any of the nutrients. And then you can make a little batter. You can make a rice batter or cassava root batter, or let's say a coconut batter, where you batter, you make a little flour, you put in a little egg replacer, put in a little rice milk, then you stir it around, put your seasonings in. If you want savory seasonings like rosemary and oregano and dill, fine. If you want a different type, a little more exotic, like ginger, cardamom, coriander, that's also fine. Anyhow, you stir it around, add in some black pepper, and then you baste your fennel that you've very thinly sliced. Then you put it on a grill, or you can put it into a pan. And then you do the same thing with some shallots, some mushrooms, and then you bake a large elephant garlic. So delicious, because once it's baked, you peel the skin off and then you bake it. Then you can just take a fork and mash inside of it and then put some olive oil in there and your seasonings. It's a wonderful way to have something a little different, a little exotic meal. Well, fennel is all around terrific for you. But a new study shows that fennel is this anise, that's A-N-I-S-E, flavored herb used in cooking, has long been known for its health benefits, including improving digestion. Did you ever notice that when you leave a Indian restaurant, there's generally three little cups with little spoons, and you're supposed to take and put a little bit of the fennel, or a little bit of the cardamom, or a little bit of the ginger, and then it helps with digestion. Well, this is really good for digestion, but this study confirms it's also effective in the management of postmenopausal symptoms like hot flashes, sleeplessness, vaginal dryness, and anxiety with no side effects. The study was published in the online journal Menopause, which is the journal of the North American Menopause Society. And we're now seeing more and more of these natural substances, what we call functional foods, being written up in very respected journals. So I think that's terrific. Now, exercise, as we know, if you do it every day, now here is the ideal of ideals. 40 minutes in the morning, 40 minutes in the late afternoon, early evening. That would be ideal, including in that exercise some intense work, where you go at a normal pace, then for 100 yards you go very fast. And then also in the gym, where you're doing your curls or push-ups or sit-ups, then you do it with intensity. The combination of the two can add 9 years onto your lifespan. According to the University of British Columbia, exercise can protect your brain from Alzheimer's. So the evidence is overwhelming at this point. Physical activity is associated with a reduced risk of Alzheimer's, and that was done by a whole group of researchers, and they're looking at over 1.1 million people in this particular study. Quote, as there is no current cure for Alzheimer's, that's not true, I did it, there is an urgent need for interventions to reduce the risk of developing it and helping manage the symptoms, end quote. Okay, exercise, a very important part of it. Now, another good thing in your diet is green tea, because from the Kyushu University in Japan, they looked at 10,000 men and women, and they found that those who had rice, and rice is a very common part of the Chinese and Japanese diet, you were far less likely to develop diabetes if you consumed green tea. And that's important. Quote, the prevalence of type 2 diabetes mellitus has increased rapidly worldwide, with the prevalence in Japan having doubled during the past two decades. Changes in lifestyle towards an excessive intake of energy, that's calories, and an insufficient energy expenditure, that's exercise, have been ascribed to the increase. Rice's higher glycemic index, that's white rice, not brown rice, and in Japan they eat mainly white rice, is thought to be responsible for the association between rice consumption and the risk of diabetes, with women more susceptible to hyperglycemia and therefore glucose intolerance, hence diabetes. In the current study, 11,717 subjects responded to trying this, and they used the green tea. And what they found was the more green tea you use, and you can get caffeine-free green tea, I might mention, the lower your risk of diabetes. Also, a good study out of University of Auckland in New Zealand finds that expressive writing can help wounds heal faster. What's this mean? It means that people who wrote emotionally about past stressful events 2 weeks before having a biopsy had their wound heal faster than people who wrote about factual day-to-day activities. The study of the effects of expressive writing before and after a punch biopsy or wound healing was published in the journal Brain Behavior and Immunity. And the aim of the study was to investigate whether expressive writing could speed the healing of these wounds, and if writing was performed either before or after the wounds were made compared to writing about neutral topics. And they found that it did. So why? What was going on? I believe they didn't have an absolute answer for that, but I have a pretty good expression. Several decades ago, at the New York Center for Marital Guidance that was run by Dr. Elaine Kahn and myself, one of the things that I tried, and it worked, was having couples who were going through problems in their relationship spend time alone journaling, but don't get up, I said, until you've finished your expression. And whatever you have to say, don't edit it. No one's going to read it. It's just for you. And one of the people I remember at the time said, well, if it's just for me, I already know what I'm thinking. I said, that's different. When you're using two different parts of the brain, when you're feeling an emotion, anger, rage, jealousy, envy, insecurity, uncertainty, immediately the DNA in your cells start to release memories of all the other times in your life that you had such emotional expressions. And then you begin to act out physically. You might end up with stomach cramps, constipation, your head hurts. And how many times have we heard people say, you know, you give me a headache, or, you know, you give me an upset stomach. You make me sick to my stomach. Well, it's not that anyone is giving you a headache. They don't. And no one can give you an upset stomach. But remembering something not from this person, but something from a past experience that was locked into the epigenetics, this warehouse of hundreds of millions of these tapes. And it's like the world's most advanced computer. The moment you see an expression, you hear a word, there is an intonation, you can react to that as if it's real. But it's not. It's just someone saying something. It's a sight. It's a sound. Look what happens when you go to a movie and you're going to a love movie and you're expected to cry, and people do, or a horror movie. Now, realistically, a horror movie shouldn't scare you because it's all make-believe. It's on a screen. Nothing's going to jump off the screen and grab you. But people scream, and their whole biochemistry is going through a virtual event as if it's actually happening in real time. So understand that in every one of the things we think we're aware of, the subconscious is actually controlling the show. At least 95 to 97% of the time, we're living subconsciously through the epigenetics preconditioned self. So when I was suggesting that you look at what happened and begin to write about it, and then write, how did you feel about it? Okay, you get all that out. And when you look at the person's writing, you'll see that they were pressing right down in the paper. You know, like their anger is showing in the strength of their grip and their wrist and their forearm, pushing that in there. Now, when they're writing something that's positive, the lighting is brighter. And the use of words are different. And that's the subconscious that's controlling that. So then when I would ask him, okay, you've written what experience you had. Now, why don't you put yourself in the shoes of the other person? How do I do that? Go to neutral. As if somehow you were the silent witness that was sitting on the shoulder and into the consciousness of the person who made you angry. You can see in their conscious. You can see their motives. You can see what's triggering their reactions or actions. Now, what do you see? Now, suddenly, a different part of the brain is taking over. You're not just expressing emotions and anger and rage and jealousy and venting it. You're looking analytically. You're looking as if this is a problem and I'm an engineer and I'm going to break this thing down and figure out how it works. And suddenly you've given them a different way of using the brain. And that's why virtually every single person I work with in my entire life, I never just look, oh, you got a symptom. Let's see if we can help them. That's secondary. What caused this problem is primary. And almost all the conditions we see, either because of the condition or as a result of the condition, we end up having certain feelings that end up causing us additional problems in our lives. So this way, you have a person that is emoting, and then you have the person who's trying to figure out what's the lesson we can learn from this, not just your lesson, but the other person's. And suddenly they start to detach, and they realize maybe someone else didn't know that they were going to do something, say something, act out in such a way that would impact this other person. So I just think that we should take time in our lives to slow everything down a bit and be more introspective. And to be truly introspective, you have to go to neutral, where the idea of your venting is not to express rage or blame towards someone, because when you do that, you suddenly make yourself the victim. Now you encase yourself in this victim shroud, and now you begin your own mourning process. So whoever comes into your life, no matter what the conversation, you will manage to turn that sooner or later, mark my words, into justifying your victimhood. As if some point the Pope should anoint you Saint Victim, and everybody can then do a collective Italian pay for the criers, who will show up at any funeral. They're paid to cry, and they cry. And it looks very effective. True story, by the way. And so everything in your life then is artificial. There's no reality anymore because you surrendered the idea that in any way, shape, or form, you're responsible for the problems you got yourself into. So much easier to blame everyone else than to take responsibility. To take responsibility, you got to be reflective. You have to be introspective. You have to go to neutral. You have to learn the lessons. You have to try to think and imagine and look at through the other person's eyes to see what was their perception. Then you can grow. So that's what I believe is the missing part of this. So when people are writing and they're writing about something that's important to them, it actually speeds up the immune response. The electrical charges in the body speed up. The immune system is immediately impacted, especially the humoral immune system. So they haven't gotten that far yet, but I'm glad they did that part of the study. And finally, is your diet making you depressed? Well, Life Extension says yes, and I agree with them, because in a society where obesity is so common, it's not even looked upon now as a problem, but it is. And a lot of it has to do with emotions and life issues without our control, but also nutritional deficiencies are common. Simply put, we are a nation that's overfed and undernourished. Typically, these disorders are caused by all forms of biochemical reactions, as well as the psychodynamics of our lives. More often than not, if there's a period in time when we cannot control the outcome and we're left in a void, we don't like that. We first get angry, then we get rageful, then we get resentful, then we project out, and when nothing changes, we go kind of despondent, we become apathetic, and in there is where our depression resides. So we can become far more optimistic. We can surround ourselves with people who are a good part of our support system to help us out, but also get yourself on a good diet. Mainly the B complex. The B complex functions in your brain and your central nervous system. If you have all the B vitamins you need, especially B12 and folic acid, a milligram of each, the cobalamin, very important, because when you have deficiencies of B12 and B9, which is folate, you end up with dementia, fatigue, confusion, depression. So get all your B-complex, get it a high good amount. Vitamin C is also important for good reason. When it comes to the brain health, vitamin C helps with neurotransmitter production, including serotonin, the feel-good molecule. So the more vitamin C you have, the more serotonin you're creating, and the better you're going to feel. It can make you feel a lot happier. Vitamin D, the sunshine vitamin, is also important, and 80% of Americans are deficient in it. So get your vitamin D. Magnesium is important. In fact, 80% of the American population do not consume the daily recommended allowance of magnesium, and I believe that's too little to begin with. And magnesium deficiency can end up causing mental and emotional health problems, including anxiety and depression, irritability, poor memory, and impaired cognition. Zinc is important too, because if you're deficient in zinc, and most people are, you end up with depression and symptoms mimicking ADHD, difficulties in learning and memory, even seizures. And the omega-3 fatty acids, especially DHA, if you're deficient, again, depression. And make sure you're getting the amino acids. A good plant diet can give that, especially the amino acid tyrosine. T-Y-R-O-S-I-N-E is very important. Tyrosine is one of the essential amino acids for the neurotransmitter serotonin and also tryptophan. So, simple things that can make a difference. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm sure all of those who voted for Trump, those who voted for Clinton, and those who voted for Jill Stein, and those who simply said a pox on all their houses, I'm not going to vote for the lesser of two evils. Jill Stein's not evil. She would have been a great president. What do we do now? Well, there's several things. I have said all along, I believe that the Democrats and the liberals should put their energy into projects that we need. And if we joined, coalesced with all the independents, we could get a universal health care. That would solve a big problem, save us over $2 trillion a year, and would save a lot of people from dying and suffering by not getting the medical treatment they need, but also getting the kind of preventative treatment that helps prevent disease. We could also help have a national program on the environment, reforesting, helping to convert our commercial farms into local family farms, supporting farmers market. These are things that are doable. But as long as everyone's filled with such anger and hatred towards the other, none of those good things will get done. And I'm curious, where does all the rage, where does that go? What does that build? What comes from this unrequited rage? In that respect, there is a need to resist, but I believe we should have to engage in constructive resistance. Yes, acknowledge the problems, but I believe Trump will not be in office in 2 years because I don't believe that he has the personal character and the fortitude to stay in a position that he and his family have absolutely no qualifications for, nor any of the people in his cabinet have any qualifications. Not that anyone else who came before him had qualifications, but he has no silken personality that he can get away with it. Barack Obama had such a smooth approach that he was like an eel going through Vaseline. I mean, he was that slippery. The crawl towards despotism is occurring now. And according to Chris Hedges, within a failed democracy, it's always incremental. What do I mean? No regime planning to utterly extinguish civil liberties and advertises its intentions in advance. Instead, it pays lip service to liberty and justice while obliterating the institutions and laws that make them possible. Its opponents, including those within the establishment, make sporadic attempts to resist, but week by week, month by month, the despot and his reactionary allies methodically consolidate power. Those inside the machinery of government and the courts who assert the rule of law are purged. Critics, including anyone in the alternative media, purged, attacked. Individuals, let's say Cornel West, Chris Hedges, any of the individuals that you're used to seeing who are not afraid to stand up and tell the truth, without exception, they're going to be ridiculed and wherever possible silenced. The state is reconfigured until the edifice of tyranny is unassailable. As an example, look at the vaccines. When we had a chance to challenge vaccine safety and efficacy, we were silent. They had all the science. So anytime someone suggested it, are you sure vaccines are safe and effective? You've never done a double-blind placebo-controlled study giving one group vaccines, another group no vaccines, following them and seeing which group did the best after 5 years. We were assured by the policymakers in Washington, by the heads of the federal agencies such as the FDA and the Center for Disease Control, and the media, don't even begin to question the safety of vaccines. You're inexperienced. You're not qualified. We have all the studies. And if you do try to resist and you keep other people from engaging in safe, effective vaccines, then you have to be responsible for the epidemics of polio and smallpox that might come back. Fair enough. But there were a few exceptions. Dr. Robert Mendelsohn, who I knew personally, had on this program regularly. He did the research and he found there was no science behind vaccines, and hence he fought it. He was the only person I knew who was fighting it at that time. That would have been 1975, 1972 to 75. Today, there are at least 6 million Americans who are resisting vaccines. Interesting, the highest educated group living in a community in the United States, Lawrence Livermore research facilities, and these are PhDs and scientists, they're capable of reading the literature, and they're resisting vaccines. So the more educated someone is, the more they resist. So guess who gets attacked? The people that give us bad vaccines? No. The people who, like Dr. William Thompson, who acknowledges fraud, deception, lying? No. Anyone who takes the information of Dr. Thompson and brings it to the public's attention. The current administration's budget proposes to give the war industry, the domestic policing agencies, the fossil fuel industry, Wall Street, billionaires, and the National Security and Surveillance Agencies more than they could have ever imagined possible before the election. These forces, as in all fascist states, will be the pillars of the Trump regime. They will tolerate Donald Trump's idiocy, his ineptitude, his unbridled narcissism, but in exchange for what? It's simple. 2 things only. Increased profits and power. Despots are often buffoons, appealing to their vanity and ego is an effective form of manipulation. Skilled sycophants can play despots like musical instruments for personal advancement. Trump, like all despots, had no real ideology. His crusade against Wall Street, including Goldman Sachs and the billionaire class during the presidential election campaign, vanished the moment he took office. He has appointed 5 former Goldman Sachs employees to high posts in his administration. His budget will bleed the poor, the working class, and the middle class, and swell the bank accounts of the oligarchs. He's calling for abolishing the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowments for the Arts, and cutting the programs that provide legal aid services to low-income people and grants to libraries and museums. If Trump's budget is approved by Congress, there will not even be a pretense of civil society. Trump and his family will profit from his presidency. Corporations will profit from his presidency. Wall Street will profit from his presidency. And the people will be made to pay. Despots demand absolute loyalty. It's why they place family members in their inner circle. The Romanian dictator, whose vanity rivaled that of Trump, and Iraq's strongman, Saddam Hussein, filled their governments with their children, siblings, nephews, nieces, and in-laws, and rounded out their inner courts with racist, opportunists, and thugs of the kind that now populate the White House. Despots distrust diplomats. Diplomats, often multilingual and conversant with other cultures and societies, deal in nuances and ambiguities that are beyond the grasp of the despot. Diplomats understand that other nations have legitimate national interests that inevitably clash with the interests of one's own country. They do not embrace force as the primary language of communication. They are trained to carry out negotiations, even with the enemy, and engage in compromise. Despots, however, live in a binary universe of their own creation. They rapidly dismantle the diplomatic corps when they take power for the same reason they attack intellectuals and artists. So in conclusion, Trump's proposal to cut of nearly 29% of the State Department budget, potentially eliminating thousands of jobs, is part of the shift away from diplomacy to an exclusive reliance on violence or the threat of violence. The militarization of the diplomatic corps, with the Central Intelligence Agency and the military intelligence operatives often taking over embassies, especially in conflict zones, began long before Trump took office. But Trump will deal the coup de grace to the diplomatic corps. Despots replace diplomats with sycophants with no diplomatic experience. Let me think. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Well, there's a good example. He ran ExxonMobil, has no experience in being a diplomat. He has all the experience in being a neocon, a corporatist, a globalist. Not what you want. And this is at a time when we really should start a major nuclear disarmament program. With the United States showing that since we have the most nukes in the world, let's start decommissioning our nukes and let's get other countries to do the same, and don't leave out Israel. Now, I want you to hear this short piece about Seth Rich. We're going to hear a lot more about Seth Rich in the upcoming months.
As a DNC staffer, the conspiracy theories online have taken a life of their own. But today, Fox 5 has learned there is new information that could prove these theorists are, in fact, right. New information from the family's private investigator suggests there is tangible evidence on Seth Rich's laptop that confirms he was communicating with WikiLeaks prior to his death. Now, the question is, why has D.C. police, as the lead agency on the investigation for the past 10 months, insisted this was a botched robbery when till this day there is no evidence to suggest that? The Rich family hired Rod Wheeler, a former MPD homicide detective, to run a parallel investigation into their son's death. Wheeler says he believes there's a cover-up and the police department has been told to back down from the investigation.
The police department nor the FBI has been forthcoming. They haven't been cooperating at all. I believe that the answer to solving his death lies on that computer, which I believe is either at the police department or either at the FBI. I've been told both.
But you have sources at the FBI saying that there is information
for
that
sure
could link Seth Rich to WikiLeaks?
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's confirmed. Actually, I have a source inside the police department that has looked at me straight in the eye and said, Rod, we were told to stand down in this case, and I can't share any information with you. Now, that's highly unusual for a murder investigation, especially from a police department. Again, I don't think it comes from the chief's office, but I do believe there is a correlation between the mayor's office and the DNC. And that's the information that's going to come out tomorrow.
Okay, yeah, let me put this in perspective. That was a former detective down in Washington, D.C., who is retired and became an investigator at the behest of the family of Seth. Here's what my office and my sources tell me, that Seth, working in the DNC, saw the corruption where Hillary Clinton's people were illegally and ethically and morally swinging away from Bernie Sanders, who had stadium fulls of people, where Hillary getting a few hundred, and yet all the media was focused upon Hillary, not Bernie. And they never thought that Bernie would pick up the momentum. They never realized how many millennials would be interested in Bernie. Well, Bernie had at least 8 really good programs that would be populist and help everyone. Hillary had none. Hillary had the corporate agenda. So he saw how they undermined Bernie. Bernie would be president of the United States today had it not been for the corruption of Hillary and the rest of her gang at the Democratic National Committee. So what we have at this moment is that approximately 24,000 emails proving all this were taken by Seth. He gave it to a former ambassador for Great Britain in a park near George Washington University. That person then got him in the hands of WikiLeaks. So when WikiLeaks joined us, all says that there is no cables we got, no emails, no hacking of the DNC by Russia, nothing at all. He has not been wrong in 10 years in all these documents. So I don't see why he would be wrong then. And what's of interest is that he offered a $20,000 reward for any information on leading to the capture of the person who killed Seth Rich, and why? Of all the people being shot every day in the world, why would he suddenly pick one human being out of all and for the first time offer a reward? Because it was his source. Now,
so there's big contributions to the overall CO2 footprint of humanity, but the piece that doesn't get as much attention as it really should is how much both our crop yields are projected to decline as global temperatures rise, how vulnerable agriculture is to a changing climate, and also how vulnerable future food security is to a continuing decline in the amount of available cropland. The UN put out, FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, a couple years back, put out a report that confirmed that we're losing about 1% of our productive agricultural capacity each year to soil degradation. And the forecast for agricultural response to climate change for the sort of the big grains we depend on, corn, wheat, and rice, are that for every 1 degree rise in global average temperature, we'll lose 10% of our harvests. You know, and those two trends, you know, if they're carried out over any kind of significant period of time, really will place food security at risk, you know, a few decades down the road. And what my new book is about is trying to look at ways that we can transform agriculture in ways that will help solve both of those problems. And, you know, when I was first on your program 8 years ago, looking backwards at the role of human action through civilizations, it was kind of hard to have an optimistic look forward. We've got a pretty bad track record. But I think there's a way to actually turn these problems around from the agricultural and soil end. The climate's a bigger problem. And that's what the new book focuses on, looking at farmers around the world who've adopted practices that flip conventional agricultural philosophy on its head, but that actually work to put more carbon in the ground and grow more food with far less chemical inputs.
David, could you please share with us what they're doing that we should do as well?
Sure. I mean, what I did is I went around and visited farmers in the developing world and the developed world to look for what are the common elements that underpin agricultural techniques that can restore fertility to the soil and do so in fairly short order. And it really boils down to sort of 3 general principles under the sort of broad umbrella of what's called conservation agriculture. And that's ditching the plow, covering up the soil, and growing a diversity of crops. So it's adopting no-till methods, but using cover crops to help control weeds instead of herbicides. And having nitrogen-fixing legumes, peas, and beans and things in the mix,
and growing not just the same crop over and over, or just corn, soy, as we tend to do in a lot of parts of this country, but growing a much more diverse set of crops, at least three or four different crops in a rotation to try and control pests and pathogens. The farmers that I visited, both large farms, you know, 20,000-acre farms in North America with wild technological sophistication, and, you know, 1 hectare subsistence farms in Africa with minimal technology other than human labor, these same principles worked to restore fertility and productivity to the soil over a surprisingly short time for a geologist like me. We're talking, you know, a few years, not centuries like I would have originally thought.
Do you find any similarities between what corporate agriculture is doing today to soil and food production with what earlier civilizations has done, particularly the Roman Empire? And then the average person simply regards soil as dirt, an inert substance with biomolecules that feed plants. Therefore, distinguish the composition of vital, healthy soil compared to the typical soil farmers relying upon using industrial chemical agriculture. And what are some of the more unusual qualities of the life of soil that portray this difference?
Well, you know, the real big difference between dirt and soil is life. You know, a healthy, fertile soil you can really view as the marriage between geology, all those mineral particles and the clay and the silt and the sand and so forth that's in it, and the biology, both the living organisms, the microbes, which turn out to be incredibly important for soil fertility, but also the dead stuff, the things that were once living but that the fungi are breaking down and recycling into the elements that help to fertilize the next generation of life. You can think of soil as essentially nature's recycling system, taking once living matter and recycling it back into the raw materials to feed the next generation of life. And there's all kinds of physical properties and other things that vary between sort of a degraded soil and a healthy living soil, and a healthy soil full of biology and full of life. And we've tended to look at agricultural soils as something to add chemicals to for the last 100-150 years and to plow intensively. And it turns out that plow-based agriculture and intensive fertilizer use change the composition of life in the soil and, in particular, limit and damage the mycorrhizal fungi, the fungus in the soil that's actually beneficial to plants and whose roots go back deep through geologic time. The very first fossil plants that we have on land that we have a record of had mycorrhizal fungi intertwined with their roots, and it's a symbiosis that's ancient. The plants photosynthesize and build sugars, the building blocks of plants, and they feed that out through their roots to the fungi in the soil, who then go out and get other nutrients and bring them back to the plants. And there's an underground economy of exchange, of cooperation between these two partners that helped plants colonize the continents and that are still there in our agricultural soils, but our mainstream sort of modern conventional methods of tillage-based, chemical-intensive monocultures has essentially compromised the biological side of healthy, fertile soil. And we're just realizing now how effective a different philosophy that undoes all that, that stops plowing, that covers the ground with cover crops to help replace the fertilizers, and that grows a diversity of crops, how all that can restore life to the soil, which can in turn restore fertility to the soil, and also store a lot of carbon in the soil, because all that life, both living and once living, the dead organic matter and the microbes in the soil, add up to a very large carbon reservoir that we can refill with agricultural techniques and take some of the CO2 out of the atmosphere that's looking to create such a problem for humanity in the near term.
Conventional industrial agriculture makes the claim it's more economical. We might believe this when we go to our grocery stores and find the price is higher for organic produce rather than the same vegetable conventionally grown. But you observe that this new agricultural paradigm would benefit farmers economically. So explain some of the economic benefits, particularly in the long term, for getting rid of conventional monocrop farming.
Yeah, you know, that was one of the things that actually kind of surprised me in researching this book, and it's one of the reasons that it turned out to be such an optimistic book, because I think that Well, all the farmers that I visited that had adopted this full suite of new regenerative farming techniques had seen such large reductions in their purchases of diesel and of fertilizer and of herbicide and insecticide that they were making more money because their harvest dipped for a couple years as they made the transition. 2 to 3 was the average of what the people I visited reported. And after that, their harvests were back up to the levels that they were using conventional techniques. So it's not a question of, you know, can we grow enough food this way? The harvests are comparable, but the input costs, all those expenses, the upfront expenses for the farmer were much lower. So it was actually more economical to farm this way. It was a different set of practices, and there's some equipment that needs to be acquired. There's a bit of a capitalization and a transition cost. But in terms of the basic year-to-year economics, it turned out to increase the profitability of every farm I visited if they adopted this full suite of things. And some of the farmers went so far as to comment that, you know, if people were to adopt these new techniques more widely, it would not result in higher crop food prices, because they can actually produce what they consider to be better, healthier food, something close to what I like to call organic-ish, because they used a few chemicals, but nowhere near what they had been using before. I mean, but they're doing it at a much lower price. So the farmers were happy. They had a better bottom line, and their environmental footprint was radically reduced.
Dave, I have a final thought, and that is, with millions of young millennials educated but not able to find work, living at home, they're now up for what we did in the 1970s, many of us moving back to the land. And I see millions of farms that at once were thriving in the United States closed down because of expensive farming techniques, and bringing those back to life, and especially upstate New York, where you can buy land inexpensively, beautiful vistas and good clean water and good topsoil. So I believe there's going to be a renaissance back to the land in the next couple of years, in part out of economic necessity, and also the people who have the mindset that they don't want to go get into the American dream and just get on a treadmill and spend the rest of life acquiring stuff they don't really need. So I believe that one of the strengths of the millennials is they haven't been overconditioned to believe that everything has to be theirs and theirs exclusively, which will mean more cooperatives, more communes, more shared living, and more intentional farms in the future, including organic techniques.
So, yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think there's a huge opportunity to try and get more young people back on the land on small farms that are actually profitable and can turn into a viable enterprise and lifestyle. I think we should be doing everything we can to encourage the viability of people who are wanting to do that. It could be one piece of this soil health revolution that I'd like to see go forward.
Well, I appreciate your new book, Growing a Revolution, Bringing Our Soil Back to Life. You're also the author of Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations, and The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health, along with your wife. And the website is digtogrow.com. Dave, thank you for being on today. Look forward to our next conversation.
Great. Thanks a bunch, Gary. Take care.
Professor David Montgomery, geomorphologist and environmentalist in the Earth and Space Sciences Division, University of Washington's College of the Environment in Seattle. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. Just